produced by the iLab at WBU.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
You are Boston.
Hey, Modern Love listeners, we're back in your feed to share a project we think you'll love. It's a new podcast called Last Scene. It's about the largest unsolved art heist in history. It's not a Modern Love story, but it is a great story from the same team that makes the Modern Love podcast. We really think you'll like it. We'll be back on Wednesday with a new episode of Modern Love featuring actress Olivia Munn. But for now, here's an excerpt from episode one of Last Scene.
We're in a strange place. Many people don't come up here. You might have to duck a lot. We're in the attic.
It's an unseasonably warm October day in Boston. The attic at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum is stuffy and dimly lit. Anthony Amore, the museum's head of security, has something he wants me to see.
We're going to go around this corner here.
At 6'2", Amore has to walk doubled over beneath the slanted eaves. We are high above galleries once ransacked by thieves in a daring overnight robbery almost 30 years ago. The attic space is dominated by a massive HVAC system. It's hum proof that it's working to keep treasures on the floors below at just the right temperature and humidity level.
Almost there.
We step out of the low amber light into much cooler air and quiet. I think this is what Amore has taken me to see. A storeroom of the sumptuous textiles used on furniture and walls throughout the Gardner Museum. But that's not why we're here. In the back of the room, in a space barely wide enough to accommodate us both, Amore puts his cell phone's flashlight on and pulls a plastic cover off something big.
Nope.
Oh, wow.
We're looking at the rosewood stretcher that held Storm in the Sea of Galilee. But what you're looking at here is Rembrandt.
Ah. So this is what was left behind after the thieves slashed Storm on the Sea of Galilee from the frame.
It is.
When the thieves slashed Christ in the Storm on the Sea of Galilee from its frame with something razor sharp like a box cutter, they left behind the edge of the painted canvas attached to the stretcher underneath. It was Rembrandt's only seascape. In it, Jesus, serene, rises to calm a raging sea aboard a fishing boat that is being battered in a mighty gale. Alongside Christ's apostles is a face we recognize. It's Rembrandt gazing out at us. In a letter dated August 30th, 1898, to her Florence-based art dealer, Isabella Stewart Gardner wrote, "Your description of the sea picture makes me fairly ache for it." I think I know what she means. I've only seen copies of the painting, but even those capture human frailty and the fury of the ocean. I can't imagine what it would feel like to stand before the original. But here I am, with the stretcher that once held it. It comes up to my shoulders at 5 feet 3 inches high, and it's 4 feet 2 inches across.
Wow, it's enormous.
Yeah, you can see why they wouldn't have been able to take it with them.
No, it wouldn't have been something you could carry out. But there's that is paint that Rembrandt put there.
Mm-hmm.
What a thing to see. It kind of takes the breath away.
In addition to that remnant of Rembrandt that the thieves left behind, they also left a clue about how they stole the priceless painting.
If you look closely here, you could see the cut into the stretcher. You see that?
Oh,
line
yeah, so
right
they were pressing hard.
Yeah.
With something extremely sharp because it's a very clean cut.
Right.
Well, it's a crime scene, really.
It's like the
chalk line of the body.
Exactly.
The murder scene.
It's a victim.
It is. It's a victim. I don't know why, but it makes me feel very queasy to look at it.
It does, yeah. I get the same feeling every time I look at it. You get, there's so much to it. It's not, it's Rembrandt, so you're in the presence of greatness, right? But you're in the presence of history, too. This is a stretcher that held one of the most valuable things that was ever stolen. Why am I this close to something Rembrandt had? I'm from Providence. There's no Rembrandt stuff like this. And, you know, it's just a awe-inspiring thing. I got to get it back. Because this is torture. You almost feel like, why did I get stuck with this? You know? Why? Because it's... Look at it, right? You understand. I can never walk away from this.
This is Last Scene. I'm Kelly Horan.
And I'm Jack Rodolico. For the last year and a half, we've been investigating the holy grail of art crime, the still unsolved robbery of 13 artworks from the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. It remains the world's greatest art heist, with a haul valued today at $500 million.
We've gone behind the scenes of the investigation with the Gardner Museum's lead investigator, and we've tracked down sources who have never before spoken publicly about what they know. We've worked closely with the Boston Globe's Steve Kirkchin, who's covered the Gardner heist for more than two decades. And we've gotten our hands on letters and a private diary, secret recordings, and police reports that have never before been given a public airing. We've mined all of it in search of new insights into this old case.
Because after 28 and a half years, without one arrest or a single recovery of any of the stolen art, we wanted to know, why hasn't this case been solved?
And all these years later, with suspects dead or dying and memories fading, can it be solved? Each of the 13 pieces stolen on March 18, 1990, was last seen on the walls and in the galleries of the Gardner Museum. Picture a four-story, 15th-century Venetian palace that's been dropped into a leafy Boston neighborhood. In Venice, the view through Gothic arched windows would be outward at the Grand Canal. At the Gardner, the stunning view is inward, of a courtyard lush with flowers, palm trees, and ferns. This palace museum was created at the turn of the 20th century by the Red Sox-loving, convention-flouting, 5'2"-ish force of nature, Isabella Stewart Gardner. Mrs. Jack, as she was known, shunned interviews, but she loved making headlines. She had her detractors, but her admirers shouted the loudest. An item in a Boston newspaper in 1875 referred to Mrs. Jack as, quote, one of the seven wonders of Boston. There is nobody like her in any city in this country. Everything she does is novel and original. She is as brilliant as her own diamonds and is as attractive. All Boston is divided into two parts, of which one follows science and the other, Mrs. Jack Gardner. When that was written about her, she was only 35 years old. It would be another decade before she would make her mark as a serious art collector, when she inherited a fortune after her father died. In the meantime, she was an avid collector of fascinating people. Many were young, beautiful, creative men. And she was a philanthropic force in a city that was becoming the Boston that we know today. But art was to be her driving passion. Toward the end of her life, Gardner wrote to a friend, "Years ago, I decided that the greatest need in our country was art." And so that is what she left. And among the artists that she gave us were the big men on canvas: Rembrandt, Vermeer, Manet, Degas. And the thieves went straight for them.
Rembrandt's only seascape, one of only 35 or so Vermeers known to exist, Not one of these stolen works has come back, not even after the museum doubled the reward from $5 to $10 million. Not the bronze eagle finial that sat on top of a silk Napoleonic flag, and not the oldest piece taken, a 12th century Chinese bronze ku, or beaker.
All 13 artworks gone, along with the thieves. Nothing about what went down in the early morning hours after St. Patrick's Day on March 18, 1990, fits the Hollywood-fueled mind's-eye notion of a museum heist. There were no cat-suited burglars rappelling from the ceiling and snaking under laser beams. There was no elegant, art-loving zillionaire who commissioned the theft so that he alone could enjoy the art from inside his fortified lair in some exotic, far-flung locale. There was nothing elegant or art-loving about the Gardner heist at all.
Not too long before
in the early hours of March 18, 1990, the city of Boston was still celebrating St. Patrick's Day. Hangovers would be widespread come daybreak. So would news that the city's most unusual museum had been the victim of a daring overnight robbery.
Good evening, I'm Casey Kaufman, and here's what's happening. A priceless collection of artwork was stolen early this morning from Boston's Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum.
It was 1 a.m. Saturday that two men posing as uniformed policemen fooled security guards here by claiming to be investigating a disturbance.
Initial estimates put the value of the stolen works at least
$200 million.
$200 million.
The 87-year-old Gardner Museum is considered one of the finest small art museums in the country.
Officials say the museum's elaborate surveillance system made no difference.
Museum officials today said it was the largest art heist in history.
Despite the confidence of museum officials that the precious artworks will be recovered, experts say they could disappear for years, perhaps forever. Brad Willis, TV4, Eyewitness News.
The thieves who pulled off the greatest art heist in history had a pretty simple plan. They dressed up in cop uniforms and rang the bell. It was 1:24 in the morning, and the thieves approached the Palace Road entrance of the Gardner Museum. There'd been a keg party nearby, a few revelers were still on the streets, and when the fake cops told the museum guard on duty that they were responding to a disturbance, it seemed plausible. Maybe some drunk kid had gotten up to some mischief. After all, earlier in the evening, the guards' rounds had been interrupted by a fire alarm blaring from the museum's carriage house outside. It had really spooked him. Maybe that's why the cops had come, and so he buzzed them into the museum.
That guard was Rick Abbath.
They came in and they turned so I could see them. I could see that they had hats, coats, badges, and they looked like cops, so I buzzed them the rest of the way into the museum.
Steve Kirkchin and Rick Abbath talked about that night at an Indian restaurant in 2013.
The first question was, is anybody else here?
I see, right.
And I said, my partner, okay, get him down here.
We're devoting our entire second episode to Rick Abbath. You'll be hearing a lot from him then. So here, we're going to let you hear from the other guard who was on duty that night, the one that Abbath called back to the security desk. This is the first time that former guard has ever spoken publicly about his experience.
I kept wondering if they might just come up behind my head with a gun with a silencer and just, you know, do it real quickly.
It was a terrifying night, and all these years later, he'd still rather we not use his full name. His first name, though, is Randy.
In 1990, Randy had a passion for symphonic music, the Moody Blues, and the trombone. He still plays, makes a living at it, mostly in house bands on cruise ships. But back then, Randy had recently earned a master's in performance from the New England Conservatory of Music. He was trying to land gigs and make ends meet.
But I always had to have some kind of a day job kind of thing to supplement the income, make sure the bills get paid, and so forth.
Randy knew a couple of people who worked at the Gardner, and that's how he landed his security job there.
It wasn't something that required you to have any kind of special skills. You know, it was, I remember being trained to, if any people were getting real close to a painting, and we were told to get them to stand back a little bit and don't get so close.
A few months into his job, Randy began filling in on the overnight shift. The pay was better, $11 an hour versus $7 or $8 for the daytime shift.
You know, at nighttime, when there are no visitors, when you're not doing a round, you can bring stuff to read. I could bring my horn and practice. I was always happy to say yes to filling in.
Randy doesn't recall any special training or specific instructions for the night shift beyond the requirement that he register his presence in each of the galleries on all the floors during his rounds. He did this by swiping a magnetic strip. He wasn't originally on the schedule to work the overnight after St. Patrick's Day. Randy was filling in for another guard who had reportedly called in sick. Abbott had told him about the carriage house alarm, but he hadn't thought much of it until he saw the two police officers talking to Abbott at the watch desk.
It never occurred to me that they might be anything but Boston police. I immediately made that connection. This might have something to do with that alarm that went off.
One of the uniformed men said he recognized Abbott and asked to see his ID.
He said, "Yeah, I do know you. There's a warrant out for your arrest." And he told Rick to stand against the wall, put his arms up. He does the pat down. He puts the cuffs on. And I'm just standing there with my jaw open going, "Wow, you know, what's going on? What did Rick do? Is he really into some kind of trouble?" And it still never occurred to me that they were anything but policemen.
By stepping out and away from the desk, Rick Abbott also stepped away from the sole means of signaling trouble to the outside world, the museum's panic button.
No sooner was Abbott against a wall and handcuffed than Randy was too.
I kept asking him over and over, "Why are we being arrested? Why are we being arrested?" And he wouldn't answer. So the cuffs are on, my hands are behind my back, and then duct tape starts going on around my eyes. So about the time that he begins putting the duct tape on, he says, "This is a robbery." And so then everything was finally crystal clear what was going on. You know, it was just really strange. None of it made any sense. And then suddenly it made a lot of sense.
I mean, it's scary enough to think you're being arrested and not know why. But what was going through your mind when suddenly duct tape is going around your head?
It's very scary. And I'm worried for my life. But they were immediately saying, I can remember both of them saying, you know, "Follow instructions and you will not get hurt." So that gave me some relief. And I just felt like, okay, don't try anything stupid. Don't try anything stupid. Go along with whatever there's nothing here in this museum that is worth my life.
The thieves wound duct tape around Randy and Abbott's heads from chin to scalp, across their eyes and across their mouths, with only a slit so they could breathe. Then, stair by stair, the robbers led the guards, who couldn't see a thing, down to the basement. One of the thieves used another pair of handcuffs to attach Randy to a drainpipe under a limestone sink near a boiler. Randy recalls that that thief was the calmer of the two, and weirdly courteous.
The guy who cuffed me, he was making sure that they weren't too tight on my wrist, and he adjusted it several times, and he said, "You're going to be here for a long time, so I don't want these to be too tight." So he was real calm and real nice about it. And he also several times said, "Sorry to have to do this."
Randy just wanted the guy to get away from him, to go do what he had come to do and to get out of there.
Were you panicking?
It was scary. And I remember feeling like I needed to prepare myself for death if it ended up coming to that.
What did that mean, preparing yourself for death?
Well, I was running music through my head a lot, just feeling like I don't know what happens to us when we die. It's all a mystery, but I just felt like I needed to be mentally prepared.
Was there a particular piece of music that you ran through your mind?
Definitely, I remember one of the pieces, the Mozart Requiem. It didn't occur to me later that has to do with that has to do with dead people.
Randy spent the next 8 hours shackled on the basement floor, terrified the entire time that the thieves would return to kill him.
If
you want to hear the full episode, subscribe to Last Scene on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And we'll have a new episode of Modern Love on Wednesday.